try this, and if the sound doesn't work, then I'll get up and probably walk away from the pulpit a few times, and y'all can just rein me in. In 1995, there was a guy who decided to go rob some banks in Pittsburgh. He robbed two banks in Pittsburgh. And he was caught immediately after doing this because he didn't wear a mask. He didn't disguise himself at all. He showed up on the cameras as clear as day. And when the police showed him the surveillance cameras and said, "This is you," his response was, "But I wore the juice." He had been under the understanding that if you smear lemon juice over your face, it makes you invisible to security cameras. It doesn't, by the way, for any of you thinking about that. A guy by the name of, I think first name was David Dunning, a social psychologist, heard this story and thought to himself, this man is terrible at robbing banks. He may be a fine individual who made a bad choice. He may be the sort of person you would want to stop by the side of the road and take care of you if you have a flat tire. But when it comes to robbing banks, he is demonstrably and categorically the worst. And he talked with a graduate student of his, Justin Kruger, and they started thinking about this and started wondering, maybe part of being bad at something, of being incompetent, is having no idea how truly bad you are. And so they did lots of studies and have found out that this is the case not just for bank robbing, but for pretty much anything we want to do. The worse we are at something, the less able we are to tell that we stink at that. It's called the Dunning-Kruger effect. So if you find yourself tweeting in the middle of the night that you are the best ever at something, you might be the best ever, or you might just be a victim of the Dunning-Kruger effect. Now, there's another principle that some of y'all may have heard of, the Peter Principle. Anybody ever hear of that? Yeah, so the Peter Principle is the idea that everyone rises to the level of their own incompetence. That when you do something well, you get promoted, and you keep getting promoted, and what keeps you from getting promoted eventually is the fact that you're promoted too high, that you're at a spot where you're not very good at. So combine the Peter Principle with Dunning-Kruger, that's dark, that's troubling. That means that pretty much everybody is going to get to a point where they're not very good at something, and they're not going to know it. I'm going to be the last person to know when I'm not good at something. And from a church perspective, from a faith community perspective, I think a good analog for that is self-righteousness. Self-righteousness, that idea that I have it figured out. And if all those other people would just get in line, we'd have a good world. That describes Saul. Now, some of you may have remembered in this story that the Saul in this story is going to get a name change right after this story happens, and he's going to become Paul. So this is the Apostle Paul that we're talking about. What are some of your, do any of you have any thoughts or feelings about Paul? Some people don't really know anything about him. Some people have very strong feelings. What do you feel about him? You don't think that he liked women very much. What else? Any other feelings or thoughts about the Apostle Paul? Wrote a lot of letters. Very dedicated. Very dedicated. Went all over the world, suffered a lot, did whatever had to be done. Absolutely. Did not shy away from conflict. Any others? And I don't want us to go too far in Paul's direction necessarily. Paul was self-supported. He wanted to make sure that everybody knew he was not in it for his own livelihood, that he was in it because it's what God called him to do. Any other thoughts about Paul? Yeah, that's a great point. So what she said was that he had problems with the church administration. He was on the fringes of the church. Like, it's hard for us to process that. He was on the fringes. And the centerpiece of the church was run by James, the brother of Jesus, not one of the 12. They had conflict. They had serious conflict, but that never kept Paul from maintaining relationship, taking up money for the church in Jerusalem, and his dedication for what he was doing. Absolutely. So one of the things that sometimes we don't know about, it turns out that we have in our Bible 13 books that start by claiming to be from Paul. Most scholars think that Paul did not write all 13 of those books. There are seven that, without question, every scholar says Paul wrote these seven. Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, 1st Thessalonians, Galatians, Philemon, and Philippians. Thank you. Then there are three that folks aren't sure about, 2 Thessalonians, Colossians, and Ephesians. Maybe Paul wrote those, maybe people who followed Paul wrote those. And then there are three that pretty much no scholar who is not a fundamentalist thinks Paul wrote. And those are 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus, what we call the pastoral epistles. Those are the ones that you're thinking that are the ones with the really strident misogynistic. They go from not very feminist to downright misogynistic. It's a little known thing in Romans 15, Paul opens that chapter by saying, send greetings to the apostle Junia. So there's a woman apostle that Paul knew and lifted up. He talked about women preaching and praying publicly in his real letters. He's an interesting dude. He's an interesting guy. He did seem to have some problems with women, but he also lifted them up in some ways nobody else around him was doing. So there's a lot going on with Paul's life, but according to N.T. Wright, all of it comes down, and I think he's right, all of it comes down to this moment, the moment in this story. See, Saul, you said dedicated. Saul was dedicated to living out truth the way he understood it. And here's what he understood from his tradition and from the Bible. He understood that the Jews were God's chosen people, right? God makes a covenant with Abraham. God makes a covenant with Isaac and with Jacob. In Deuteronomy, God says, you will be my people and I will be your God. That's just the way that this people understand themselves and how Paul understands himself. And he understands that not just for the good of the Jewish people, but for the good of the world. This is about saving the world. The promise that God makes to Abraham is, I will bless you, I will make your descendants as great as the sand on the beach, the stars in the sky, but all the world will be blessed through you. So the calling of the Hebrew people is about blessing and saving the world. But the Jews are in exile, they're in diaspora, and why is that? Because Paul believes, like the prophets believed, they were impure. They were not following the covenant they had made with God. And Saul believed that biblically you cleanse impurity with all different ways, with prophecy, but one of the ways that you cleanse impurity is through violence. And that's just in our scriptures. So anybody remember the story of Noah? That's a very violent story, killing everyone on the planet except for six people and a lot of animals. Ladybugs came out very well in the deal. Right? There's Achan, a guy named Achan, who stole some silver and gold that was supposed to go to the temple, and him and his whole family, every bit of him and his life were stoned in the middle of the community. Korah and Dothan tried to start questioning Moses' authority, and God had the earth just swallow them up and their families whole. Apparently, impurity can go as far as calling someone bald. Elisha had a she-bear come out of the woods and chow down on some people who called him bald. In the scripture, impurity is cleansed. One of the ways it is cleansed is through violence. And Saul just understood this to be true. But he also believed that once it was pure, the Jewish nation would be justified by God before God's great cleanup. And how that would be known is all the dead would be raised. So the resurrection of all the dead would happen, and then this new world order, this new heaven and new earth, this new thing where all nations come to Zion, to the mountain of the Lord, seeking truth, that would happen, the benefit of the whole world. And so that's his understanding of life, and Christians are part of that impurity business. And he's dedicated himself to helping his understanding of Judaism thrive, and then this happens. This story that Alan read, where everything changes, and he can't deny it. And it's confusing because resurrection happened to one, not to everybody. And it's confusing because that must mean that God's great cleanup, the new world order, is somehow already underway. And it's happening through Jesus, of all people. This guy, peasant rabbi, humiliated, killed the empire. This is who God lifts up. Everything he thought he knew was wrong. And this is really hard to process experientially. So I'm going to ask you to think about someone, maybe a famous figure, maybe a politician, someone you really just do not like or trust. I have a guy on Facebook who just simply cannot stand Bernie Sanders, thinks Bernie Sanders lies at every opportunity. This is somebody from Burlington who was in Burlington when Bernie was the mayor and just can't stand him. And he's talking about how much he lies. What if an alien from the future came and told him everything Bernie Sanders says is true and he is the best hope? Like, how would that guy feel? His whole world would have to be sort of rethought. You know, it's come to my attention, there may be some folks who don't think that President Trump necessarily tells the truth at every opportunity. And if you know, I imagine, what would somebody feel like who's in that camp if an alien from the future came and said everything he's ever said is 100% true and he is hope for peace in this world? How would worldviews change? That's what Paul is experiencing. That complete disconnect of I thought I understood so clearly, and then Jesus happened. What do you do with that? Many of us would pretend it didn't happen. And I know that's true because I've been paying attention to hashtag MeToo. And I've been brought up to disbelieve that happened. We're very good at that when we want to. Some of us maybe would change. That's hard, but we might. But Paul goes way beyond that. Paul doesn't just accept it, and Paul doesn't just change. Paul boasts about it. Paul boasts about it, not because of what it says about him, but because of what it says about God. Paul says, if God can save me, God can save anybody. And if God can save anybody, then God can save everybody. You know how liberating it is to not feel like you have to save the world? Do you know how liberating it is to not have to be right all the stinking time? How liberating it is to be okay with being wrong? We're taught to be scared of being proven wrong. This is the greatest thing that ever happened to Paul. This is what Paul bragged about. I was proven wrong as anyone could be. It's so freeing to be liberated from self-righteousness, the grace of Jesus Christ. I don't have to fix other people. Jesus can do that. More importantly, Jesus can fix me. Now, I'm about to go from preaching to meddling. You know the difference between preaching and meddling? Preaching is what you do to other people. Like preaching is what somebody is saying to other people. Meddling is what somebody's saying to me. But that's the great thing about being a visiting pastor. I can meddle. The Dunning-Kruger monster is lurking all the time. The Peter principle guarantees it. We're going to get ourselves in situations where we're so wrong, we're the last people to know how wrong we are. And how do we figure that out? How do we find that out? Maybe we're so special that, like Paul, Jesus Christ will come to us in a vision. It's possible. Jesus, I believe, has done that with other people. I'm a big Julian of Norwich fan. Maybe. But it's more likely we need each other. It's more likely that the way we find out, the way I find out that I'm being self-righteous about something is I surround myself through time and habit like you have today, braving bad weather. I surround myself with people who love me enough to say, I know this is really hard to hear, but I know who you want to be, and you weren't being that person right then. And you're not being that person right now. I think that's one of our vaccinations against finding ourselves in a situation like Saul. We are so desperately wrong. We need each other. We need those people around us who are centered around those values that we hold the most dear. It's easy, isn't it? It's my life, I'm a second career pastor. My life was changed through small group interaction. And the small group happened on, I think, Tuesday nights most of the time. And that's a big chunk of your life. For every Tuesday night, getting out and going to this thing. And what was invariable was about 6 o'clock, I would think, I have so many things to do. I really don't want to do this tonight. And by about 9 o'clock, I was thinking, I am so glad I did that. I have been so blessed. We gather around each other. We gather around the truth, the grace of Jesus Christ. And somehow we are liberated and freed from our self-righteousness. This world is so beautiful in all of its gorgeous messiness. I have that's a fly. I thought it was a ladybug on my finger, and I was about to tell you how beautiful that messiness was, which it is. We are surrounded by God's wonder. So I'll leave you with a quote by wrongologist Catherine Schultz. She has one of the most heard TED Talks. She ended one of her talks with this. If you really want to rediscover wonder, you need to step outside of that tiny, terrified space of rightness and look around at each other and look out at the vastness and the complexity and the mystery of the universe and be able to say, wow, I don't know. Maybe I was wrong. And I think Paul would add, and things are so much more beautiful than I ever imagined.